Hello, and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast, Episode 23, The March to Scotland. When we last left the Jacobite Command, they'd made the decision to halt the advance to London and instead retreat to Scotland. One debate that often features in Jacobite history is the what-if of if Charles had ignored his officers and instead pushed on to London. Murray Pittock, in his work on the Battle of Culloden, argues that the way was open and the Jacobites had the momentum and were very, very fast moving. He argues that they could have reached the city, but like Edinburgh, it's unlikely they would have taken the fortresses and the populace may not have been as friendly. Suffice to say, it would have been a tall order to occupy the capital, but the Jacobites had done stranger things and fared more adverse odds. This what-if is open to massive interpretation, but I'm happy to debate the point, albeit I feel they wouldn't have taken London. So, returning to our narrative, Charles, despondent on his horse, begins his march back north on December 6, 1745. At first, the men thought they were rallying to march forward and take London and take on the Duke of Cumberland at the same time, but their joyous mood soured considerably when they realised they were in fact in retreat. Johnston recalls in his memoirs that the men were proven to rage and lament, venting their fury and sadness at not being consulted or being able to take on the enemy directly. The only thing that could be taken as a positive for Charles was that now there were no desertions from his band of fighters, though this was as much out of loyalty to the cause as it was to the fear they'd be killed by anti-Jacobite English mobs. The Duke of Cumberland, spoiling for a fight, was somewhat taken aback. He was planning to engage the enemy when he heard that they'd in fact turn around and appeared to be heading back north towards Scotland. For Cumberland, at least, now the chase would be on. He'd wanted to get after Charles, but was told by his subordinates it was going to be at least 2 days before the British army would be able to mount a march in pursuit. Cumberland was not thrilled, but for the British establishment, this was a chance to breathe a massive sigh of relief. This was the closest Jacobite forces had ever come to the capital and threatening the establishment on the mainland. Now, of course, the war in Ireland that started in 1689 occupied several cities, but I'm sure that to some listeners it will come as no surprise that London's attitudes were somewhat Anglo-centric. Nonetheless, it appeared that the immediate threat on London by Charles had diminished. There was also the somewhat relieving fact that there wasn't a complementary strike by the French. Now, I might be reading more into this, but I honestly think the Hanoverians were probably more relieved at that, as the lack of French military intervention shows that not only could the government possibly defend London and resist the Jacobite advance, but there appeared to be no coordination between the Jacobite army and the court of Louis XV. At worst for the Hanoverians, it meant communication was delayed or lacking. And at best for George and Cumberland, it meant that Charles was acting alone and they could surge forward and try to crush this rebellion before the French got any ideas. The Jacobites began their fighting retreat with Cumberland's forces in pursuit. Cumberland was well informed of Jacobite movements, but his force could not match the Jacobites in speed. Charles and his army were pushing at a hard pace, resulting in a game of cat and mouse across England. Government troops would reach a city, only to find that Charles's men had moved on, leaving only the old and sick soldiers to face the army. In treatment terms, the Jacobites, of course, would be under no illusions. Not only was this the days long before the Geneva Convention, promising soldiers basic standards, but the gentlemanly conduct only existed at a level of enemy forces between nations. Forces inside a country would be treated as rebels and face the full wrath of Cumberland's army. One such unfortunate was a Jacobite conscript who served the prince. After being captured at Prestonpans, he was executed within the hour, which was a standard punishment for those who deserted the British army. We'll talk more on this later, but suffice to say, the only Jacobite troops who could hope for leniency from Britain were the Royal Écossais and the Irish Piquet, some of whom were standing forces in the French army. Cumberland was relentless, though, and when the Jacobites arrived at Shap in Cumbria, they found government forces were reportedly only a mile behind them. Lord George Murray, who had once again had to dissuade Charles from attacking earlier in Lancaster, decided the time was prime to strike government forces. Cumberland's advance consisted of around 4,000 men, and had been receiving reports from Kendal that the Duke of Perth's servant had been captured by a local mob, seizing many valuable Jacobite papers and ciphers for their codes. Murray decided the government force could be taken out, and he'd found a spot called Clifton Moor upon which to do it. Having asked Charles to commit forces to an attack, Murray wanted to press what he thought was his advantage. Some sources say that Charles didn't wish to commit the army to an all-out assault, either fearing annihilation by a better equipped force, or possibly still smarting and wanting to teach George a lesson for not letting him attack in Lancashire. Nonetheless, roughly 1,000 Jacobite troops took up defensive positions in Clifton. As the Hanoverian dragoons opened fire at a distance of 150 yards, the Jacobites, led by Lord Murray and Cluny Macpherson, let out a battle cry of Claymore and charged the dragoons, and managed to push them back. A firefight ensued, but once the Jacobites were sure the enemy had kept its head down and was in hiding, Murray began to give the order to withdraw. Clifton was less a battle and more of a skirmish, but when the Duke of Cumberland described it as a little thing and trifling, his claim that he terrorised the rebels really doesn't hold water, as the troops were held off by the Jacobite fighting rearguard. We can't take away from the Jacobites that they carried out a successful fighting retreat. They were still moving further away from London and headed for Scotland, with most hopes diminishing by the day. The Jacobites pushed on to Carlisle, while Cumberland rested his men. Returning to the city they'd so triumphantly taken barely a month before, the mood this time was decidedly different. That said, some older post in Carlisle was informed that Charles that not only were there more troops, arms and money, but that King Louis was encouraged but advised caution. He wanted to wait for total French support. Charles, no doubt, felt better that supplies and arms had reached Scotland, though he'd have preferred to hear it in Derby so he could have convinced his staff of the march on London. On the plus side, though, it did give Charles a proper reason to head for Scotland. He and his war council had decided unanimously to return to Scotland to rally all the Jacobite troops in one area for a renewed push. Although this wasn't the complete council, as Lord George Murray wasn't present, and Charles had stated he had no desire to listen to that council ever again. I might not be an expert on leadership, but even I know you need dissenting voices to be able to lead effectively and steer towards the best decisions, so I somewhat questioned Charles on this point. Carlisle was the next staging post for the journey north to Scotland, but the prince insisted on leaving a garrison of English volunteers, most of which were the remnants of the Manchester Regiment. This frustrated some officers, such as Johnston, who not only refused to have his troops have anything to do with the garrison, but also accused Charles rather cruelly of using the English. In Johnston's mind, the English Jacobites, possibly as payback for their rather lacklustre support, would draw the wrath and ire of Cumberland's army, while Charles and the Scottish troops headed back over the border. Other than Johnston being flat out wrong and there being more Scots left at Carlisle, as well as some in Irish, Jacqueline Riding, in her book on the 45, presents the argument that Charles simply acted along his original plan. Despite his willingness to follow the plan with the council, he'd never truly given up on the throne. In Charles's mind, this was not the end. This was a stutter step. The garrison was left in England to hold the fort, whilst he headed to Scotland and gained more troops. Then he'd march down to England and take back his father's throne as planned. The governors of Carlisle town and fort were under no illusion, however. They knew that no matter what Charles's ideas and intentions, the reality on the ground is, sooner rather than later, Cumberland was going to hit Carlisle and hit it hard. The men saw it as a duty to sacrifice themselves for the prince, but it didn't mean they had to be thrilled at the prospect. They didn't have to wait long, as the Jacobites left on December 20th, 1745. Cumberland's troops arrived on the 21st, and the artillery arrived on Christmas Eve. By December 27th, the government's forces were launching a full assault on Carlisle, only pausing to wait 2 days for more artillery shells. The government had brought a battery of 18-pounder guns to show they meant business. The Jacobite holdouts continued, but even they could see the writing on the wall. Colonel Hamilton, the governor of Carlisle Castle, sent a message to Cumberland to discuss under what terms surrender could be considered. To emphasise their willingness to capitulate, a white flag was hung from the castle battlements. Cumberland, in no mood to negotiate, replied that in return for the gates of the town and castle being open to government forces, the Jacobites would not be instantly executed, but detained and subjected to the king's pleasure. On top of this, Cumberland ordered all small arms were to be handed in, troops were to imprison themselves in the cathedral, and there were to be no acts of Jacobite sabotage. The surrender of Carlisle wasn't universally accepted by the Jacobite defenders. Some, including Colonel Townley, who governed the town, seem to have been ready to fight to the death, but confronted with the fact that without the garrison there was no defence of Carlisle, Cumberland seemed pretty peeved as well. It was his feeling that the men could have blooded their blades on these rebels, but instead decided, since they were the first city in England to capitulate to the Jacobites, examples must be made. The mayor and the town clerk were seized for later judgment of their actions in being there when Charles declared James VIII and III king. The Jacobite officers, including Hamilton and Townley, were kept in the castle, while all regular Jacobite troops were kept in the cathedral. Accounts of these fighters complain of being robbed of everything of value and forced to stay in the cathedral without basic food and water. The British government was going to either execute these men as traitors or sentence them to transportation to the colonies in Americas to labour for a period of indentured servitude to pay for their treachery against King George II. With England secure in an act that would spawn commemorative medals, Cumberland headed back to the southeast, keen to help his father George neutralise the French invasion. To carry on fighting the Jacobites, Cumberland left his army in the hands of Lieutenant General Henry Hawley, also known as Hangman Hawley. Henry Hawley had been in the army since the reign of Queen Anne, as a lieutenant colonel of dragoons, before killing a fellow officer in a duel in 1710, for which he eventually was given a royal pardon, since it was given standard to settle disputes via duel at this time. When the House of Hanover took the throne, Hawley served with the government at Sheriffmuir before fighting on the European continent. Hawley was a loyal subordinate of Cumberland, and would continue his campaign as he wanted on December 20th. The Duke of Cumberland had appointed him Commander-in-Chief of Scotland. On the same day, his 25th birthday, Charles and his army crossed the border into Scotland. The weather was cold and wet, and it took the army an hour to ford the River Esk. Lord George Murray wrote of how Scottish soldiers lit fires and danced reels, partly to dry off and partly to celebrate returning to their homeland. The troops made their way into Scotland through lowland loyalist territory. In their own accounts, the Jacobites themselves described at this point that their forces' march descended into various episodes of extortion and vandalism. The Scots magazine described how Jacobites demanded shoes, gunpowder, arms and horses, while another historian wrote that after Charles stayed at the Drumlanrig Castle, the Jacobite troops had slashed pictures of William, Mary and Anne in the hallways. The Jacobite army entered Glasgow on Christmas Day 1745. Lord George was heading the group as Charles took in Christmas hospitality at the home of the Duke of Hamilton. Glasgow at this time was one of the most prosperous cities in Scotland, given the trade routes that had opened up with the Act of Union with England and its access, therefore, to English colonial markets, which would now be British colonial markets. Not only that, but Glasgow was one of the most anti-Jacobite cities. Andrew Cochrane, the provost, had publicly proclaimed his allegiance to the House of Hanover. Charles would join his troops on Boxing Day, December 26, for those of you who don't celebrate that particular holiday. Despite the relatively high spirits of the Jacobite forces, the march had taken its toll on the army over the last 4 weeks. One account described them as ragged vagrants with straggling beards, errant hair and bare feet. In some cases, bare-legged too. There were many accounts of Jacobite soldiers stopping civilians and robbing them of their shoes in the city. Charles, conscious of not only the look of his army and reports of thievery, lowering perceptions, he decided to draft in the city itself. He ordered them to provide 12,000 linen shirts, 6,000 pairs of stockings, 6,000 coats, 6,000 bonnets, and 6,000 pairs of tartan hose. He also demanded the subscription list for the local militia, on pain of death. Charles would meet in Glasgow and was somewhat put out. There were no cheers, no ringing of bells, and when he requested a delegation of magistrates from Glasgow to meet him, they all refused. To everyone around him, Charles was very vocal about the fact that not only did Glasgow not contain a single friend to him, but they went out of their way to show their opposition to the Jacobite cause. With this snub, Charles was keen to head north to Inverness to regroup with his army. On the way, with a stop at Perth to meet at a detachment of Jacobites, but first he and his army rang in Hogmanay in Glasgow, then packed up in January and moved to Stirling. Stirling is a relatively small town in Scotland, but the major attraction at the time, and to some today, is the castle. Stirling had been the site of a castle that was not only the home of the Scots royal family for centuries, but was also a major fortress that controlled access to the Highlands, and along with Edinburgh Castle, made up the two places an army would want to control to secure the lowland of Scotland and access to the Highlands. Charles arrived with his troops and attempted to besiege the castle, a move felt pointless by men like Johnston, given that Highland troops were better at fast assaults than drawn-out sieges. The siege was joined by Lord John Drummond, whose Royal Écossais troops and French guns were integral to the plan. Charles settled in at Bannockburn House, being nursed by a young lady called Clementina Walkinshaw, who we will hear more of later. Lord George Murray, meanwhile, had moved his army to Falkirk, and Lord Elcho stationed his cavalry in Linlithgow. Lord George had decided to launch raids on the local area to seize supplies the locals had kept for advancing government forces. This roused the attention of General Hawley, who'd recently marched into Edinburgh, believing the Jacobites would try and take the capital again, only relocating to Glasgow after he'd heard of Stirling being besieged. He was intent on relieving this siege, and so marched on Falkirk. The Jacobite army was undergoing a bit of a growth spurt at this point. New troops arrived from the clans Gordon and Mackenzie, as well as Simon Fraser, the son of the constantly wheeling and dealing Lord Lovat of the Frasers, who'd finally committed 600 Fraser of Lovat men to the Jacobite cause. Also present were the clans Mackintosh and Farquharson. They were sent by Lady Anne Mackintosh, wife of the chief of Clan Mackintosh, and a woman deserving of airtime on this podcast. The contribution of women to the Jacobite cause during the 1745 Rising was not always prominent, was sometimes subjected to scurrilous slander from Whig and Hanoverian propaganda, with many portrayed as ditzy, weak-minded girls throwing themselves at the bonny Prince Charles. Anne Mackintosh was not one of these. Her husband, though hesitant to back either side initially, eventually signed up with the Hanoverians. Soon after he left for London, Anne rode round the lands of Moy Hall and drummed up support for the prince, using clan loyalty, money, and some violence. Those men were led by Alexander MacGillivray of Dunmaglass to a meet with the Jacobite forces at Falkirk. The government troops under Hawley pitched camp and rested their 10,000 troops outside Falkirk, while Lord George Murray received word of their camp and decided, after doing a preliminary recon, to abandon his intended battlefield and conferred with Prince Charles about taking Falkirk Hill near Hawley's camp, forcing the government troops to fight a literal uphill battle. Charles vigorously approved and sent 1,000 men to the Duke of Perth and took the remaining 7,000 to Falkirk. Charles and Murray were intending to take the summit of the hill, sending a detachment of troops under John Drummond to Hawley to distract government forces. At around 4 p.m. on January the 17th, 1746, General Henry Hawley was at Callendar House, ready to partake of his evening meal, when news arrived to him that Jacobites had been spotted approaching the camp and had caught government forces completely unawares. I say completely unawares, but Hawley's troops had seen them in the morning. Hawley just decided it wasn't worth chasing or following. Now they were on his doorstep. It was a mad scramble. Confusion reigned about what orders to give and how to respond to this Jacobite incursion. The dragoons were called into action by Hawley, who was confident a good dragoon charge, just like he'd led at Sheriffmuir in 1715, would see the problem off. The only complication was these Jacobites were not the same animal as 30 years ago. The forces of Prince Charles had thoroughly routed dragoons and other troops at Prestonpans. They'd also received training from the Irish troops backing them up, adding more than just the Highland charge that the government troops anticipated. The dragoons had no idea regarding this and prepared to mow down a charging, sword-wielding enemy. When they got within range, Lord George Murray ordered the front line to drop to its knees and fire a musket volley straight into the dragoon lines. They couldn't escape. Musket balls tore into rider and horse alike. The dragoons turned tail and fled, almost crushing their own infantry who were advancing behind them, and further besmirching the reputation of British Army dragoons during this rising. The government nose had been bloodied by the Jacobites again. The Macdonalds on the right flank of the Jacobites, this particular spacing will become very important to a later engagement, so just remember, Macdonalds, right flank. They pursued the fleeing troops, and here's where discipline of government forces gave them a small advantage, but it was an important one. The government troops advancing uphill formed themselves into musket squares for infantry formation, and using their fire in a constantly advancing line, which has been referred to in some military tactics as the thin red line, they pushed back the charging Highlanders, switching to bayonets when one or two got too close. The Jacobites seemed to break at this point. Their second line began to run, but the Royal Écossais and Irish Piquets plugged the gap and forced a continual retreat. In the rear of the baggage train of the government army, Hawley's troops rallied, but the weather got worse. The rain was coming down in torrents and threatening to soak the men and all the powder in their guns. Hawley instead ordered the camp to be burned and that the army itself would retreat to Linlithgow. The Jacobite army under Lord George Murray arrived to partake of what was left of the supply train, with its ammunition, provisions, and hampers of wine and liquors from the officers' mess. Prince Charles spent the night at Callendar House, where he helped himself to some of General Hawley's supper. Some within Jacobite command had wanted to chase the government army, but the weather was getting worse and the nights were drawing in, worsening the visibility, and so the decision was made to withdraw to Falkirk. The soldiers of the Jacobites contented themselves with not only looting the baggage train, but stripping dead officers of the government force of any of their valuables. The Battle of Falkirk was a muddled engagement, but despite being pushed back on one flank, the Jacobites had the most advantage and gain from the fight. Losing 50 men and having 80 wounded, compared to 350 dead and wounded, and 300 prisoners taken from the government side. The mood on the government side was extremely forlorn. General Hawley wrote a letter to Cumberland to explain the loss. He announced his heart was broke, and then wheels between fury and despair, as he claims all underestimated the Jacobites, arguing both sides push back their own left flank, and then roundly accusing his men of open cowardice. He would later hang 31 troopers for desertion to the rebels, and shot 32 for cowardice. Brutal sentences to a modern audience, but standard punishment at the time, albeit one that was more to do with Hawley finding scapegoats than maintaining military discipline. Falkirk wasn't a resounding defeat, but it helped highlight the shortcomings of the most unhappy but most dutiful Henry Hawley. Having known of the Jacobite threat, Hawley chose to ignore this threat until it was on his doorstep. Taking in the prejudices that the Jacobites were ragtag claymore-wielding plaid wearers who'd run at the charge of a dragoon, and then facing the reality of a disciplined, organised force who'd already seen off dragoons repeatedly, the forces under Hawley turned and ran. The government forces had received a not insignificant kicking. When word reached Cumberland down south, he resolved to head back up to Scotland and with a mix of determination and frustration, definitively crush the rebellion once and for all. Because as the old adage goes, if you want a job done right, do it yourself. Cumberland arrived in Edinburgh on January 30th, 1746, with an aim to advance on Stirling and relieve the besieged garrison. In a measure of poetic justice, after receiving a rapturous welcome, Cumberland spent time at Holyrood, sleeping in the same rooms that Charles had when he took the city. Up until this point, the siege had not gone greatly for the Jacobites. The Comte de Mirabeau had been in charge of the siege artillery and had made some damage to the exterior walls, but the garrison returned fire with deadly accuracy, and snipers had been picking off Jacobite besiegers. A few soldiers had taken the opportunity for the lull in activity to desert back to their houses as well. And with no progress being made and the advance of Cumberland, the writing was on the wall. The chiefs and Lord George Murray amongst them wrote a letter to Charles advising it be best to call off the siege altogether and fall back to the Highlands, where they could rally together as one force to an army of close to 10,000 and try again in the spring, seizing all the Highland forts and consolidating territory before trying again on the south. Charles was, to put it very mildly, upset. He wrote a letter back to the chiefs decrying their desire to retreat, believing that the enemy may still follow and that more damage would be done abandoning the lowlands. In private, it was said to be worse, with Charles banging his head off a wall and cursing Murray, despairing what France and Spain would think of this retreat. Charles announced to the chiefs that he washed his hands of the consequences of their decisions. Understandably, this was all valid, but outvoted again, Charles didn't have any choice but to order a retreat February 2nd, 1746. Divisions between the prince and his commander only worsened on the retreat north. Following muddled orders and a disastrous accident at St. Ninian's Church outside of Stirling, the Jacobites had attempted to stop locals from stealing their ammunition and gunpowder, but either through accident or sabotage, the church had blown to pieces, killing several and almost wounding the prince himself. Lord George Murray burst in at Charles's dinner, furiously condemning the retreat, at least according to O'Sullivan later. And at a war council on the road, George was only spoken to people when addressed, including Charles. It was a rearing of George's ego again, which further caused a rift exploited by George's rivals. Cumberland was in hot pursuit, reaching Stirling only a day after the Jacobites left. 3 days later, he was in Crieff and headed to Perth, having discovered the Jacobites had split into two groups, one heading to Blair Castle, the other to Montrose. Cumberland wasn't sure which group to pursue, but in the meantime, the troops were let off the leash with permission to raid and plunder. In the lands of those who followed the prince, Cumberland felt this was a police action now, mopping up remnants of Stuart forces, including waging war on women, the elderly, and property in Jacobite sympathising areas, to demoralise the fighting men, showing what would happen to those who defied the king. Charles had spent time at Blair Castle, home of Lord George Murray's brother, the Duke of Atholl, who supported Hanover and had currently fled south at this point. He then moved on to Moy Hall, home of the aforementioned Lady Anne Mackintosh, who laid on full hospitality and dinner for the prince. Charles was invited to spend the night, and he felt he could do so without having to rely on a massive security. Lady Anne, however, wasn't convinced and asked for her blacksmith from the estate by the name of Donald Fraser to gather a small group of men and patrol the grounds. And frankly, it was lucky they did. The government forces under a detachment of the Earl of Loudoun had heard that the prince was dining at Moy Hall and in what would modern military people would call a decapitation strike, moved to have his men seize the prince and cripple the Jacobite movement. Loudoun's men were spotted, and Donald Fraser employed some cunning, shouting out to the Jacobite regiments who weren't there and firing in Loudoun's general direction. The government forces fell for this ruse, believing they were facing a far numerically superior force and fled, with several hundred later deserting. With the Jacobites focusing their intentions on Inverness, both Loudoun and Duncan Forbes felt the city could not be defended and retreated to the Black Isle. Forbes tried to regroup in Dornoch, while Loudoun carried on all the way to the Isle of Skye. Charles arrived in Inverness on February 18, 1746. Inverness, known as the capital of the Highlands, surrendered without violence or resistance, and being on the River Ness, now provided water access to the sea via the Moray Firth, which allowed for supplies from France to have a port to land in. This did happen with mixed success on February 21, 1746 at Peterhead, near Aberdeen. Two French ships of an original four managed to run a Royal Navy blockade with more men, money and munitions. They couldn't hang around, however, as Aberdeen was evacuated following reports of the arrival of the Duke of Cumberland. Cumberland headed up the East Coast roads and arrived by February 27th. By this time, Prince Charles had based himself in Duncan Forbes's now abandoned family home of Culloden House. The Jacobites had also seized Fort George in the city and destroyed it, not to be confused with the current Fort George in Ardersier. Charles directed the troops leaving Aberdeen to secure Elgin in order to prevent Cumberland's men crossing the River Spey. Cumberland was indeed planning to do that, but first decided to give his men a rest, given that the River Spey was currently extremely high and would be needlessly reckless to try and cross. He ordered the navy to ship supplies for his men and prepared to tighten the noose on the Jacobites. Next time, we reach one of the biggest milestones in the Jacobite campaigns, as Charles Edward Stuart, Prince of the House of Stuart and Jacobite heir, will take his armies to a spot on Dromossy Moor to confront the forces of William Augustus, Duke of Cumberland, in a fight that will go down in British history as the Battle of Culloden.